Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
On the last episode of Guilt.
Yeah, we looked everywhere for any sign of obvious violence, like blood or things like that. Never found anywhere. There's no one there that particularly hated him, or there's no one. There doesn't seem to be any reason that someone would hurt him.
Yeah, it's quite a big place, the mill, and even not the buildings. There's tunnels underneath, full of cable tunnels, and then there's also all the land that goes down to dams that they pump water to. And
yeah.
So, you know, it's quite a big area to search.
It's violence that may disturb some people.
Today we can officially announce that New Zealand Steel has cracked the code.
On the 21st of June 2004, scientist Jim Donnelly vanished from his work at the Glenbrook Steel.
From Brevity Studios in New Zealand, I'm Ryan Wolf, and this is Guilt.
There was nothing in the early days to indicate that we were looking for somebody who had been any misadventure.
Hands and knees, and you don't know what you're going to find. It started off as a joke, and then it got rather scary.
I just asked if anybody out there has any information that can help me put this victim home.
If you're listening to this episode at the time of its release, thank you so much for your patience, especially our Brevity Plus subscribers that have hung around. I know it's been a while, and so many of you have been desperately keen to hear more about this case, and I'm very glad to be getting more episodes live now. The recent discovery that we'll be welcoming a first addition to our family meant that a planned overseas trip had to be brought forward, which caused some delay, and I apologize for that. And also, one of the realities of a live investigative podcast like this is that some things genuinely just take time. Procuring interviews can be a long, slow process, and it's important to me that I only release episodes that add value to the case to ensure that the podcast is authentic and accurate, and not just for the sake of entertainment. While I will always try and release episodes in a regular, consistent fashion, it is simply not always possible. There are many variables. The amount of hours that go into every episode are immense, and I can assure you that I'm doing all I can to bring you as much great content as possible. So with that, again, thank you, and let's get into it. Note, some names of past and present employees have been changed for their own privacy. Today's episode is one that is going to confuse you, but also hopefully have you thinking. These things don't make sense. But for the first time, I'm going to bring all of these elements together in one place. We're going to learn about a new, previously unknown or overlooked piece of evidence, which I think could point to a completely new theory. And we're going to hear from a few very important people. The first was one of the last people to ever see Jim alive. and will describe Jim's bizarre behaviour on the morning of his disappearance. And another is someone who you've likely never heard mentioned in any media reports. And this is largely because his connection to Jim's case is related to a particular piece of evidence which I personally feel has been overlooked. And this is the discovery of Jim's dirty pants in a pile of clean laundry in a completely different area of the mill on the 29th of June 2004, 8 days after Jim's disappearance. Jim is often described by mill staff as being a bit odd or difficult to work with. When I spoke to Chris, who was one of the last people to see Jim the morning he disappeared, and asked him what he could recall of Jim's behaviour, the odd thing was, what stood out the most wasn't Jim's normal, somewhat difficult personality. Instead, it was the fact that on the Friday, 3 days before his disappearance, Jim seemed to be in the best mood he'd ever seen. For his own privacy, this interview has been read by an actor.
Well, I could take you back to, we're missing on the Monday morning, if I remember rightly, and I could take you back to the Friday afternoon, actually. We had a safety meeting upstairs. So I worked four on, four off Ross to see, and he was a production engineer. So he was on just days, you know, eight-hour days. So he was on the Friday afternoon heading home, like, for the week, and I was on my first day shift. So then I did the Thursday, Friday, and then the Saturday night and the Sunday night. So I finished Monday morning. So on the Friday, we had a safety improvement meeting, and we were looking at some improvements on an automatic bender for the coils at the steel mill. And so we're in this meeting with quite a few others. I can't exactly remember who, but just management. And so I put an idea through for this automatic bender, which puts steel strips around the coils, basically, to stop them unwinding like a big toilet or toilet rolls that are, you know, steel sheets. And he sort of took to my idea quite well, and he was getting quite excited over it. Like, he was like, phew, it's pretty awesome. And I've sort of never really seen him so upbeat as such myself, because he's an odd dude. I mean, like, it'd be like one day he'd talk to you, and on other days he'd walk straight past you. Like, in a one-on-one situation, it just looks straight through you, you know? Yeah, it's almost, super intelligent, you know, one of those real intellectual guys out there. These technicians, you know, they're just a bit different, you know? And sometimes some of them that intelligent, they lack common sense. I've seen that over the years. Well, I wouldn't say I don't know if he's lacking common sense, but he was just in another dimension, you know?
But that Friday, though, he just seemed more upbeat than you'd ever seen him.
Exactly. And it was noted, and, you know, subconsciously with myself, like, far out, Jim's in a good mood today, you know. And anyway, so the meeting was over. We walked out together, and it was like, haha, sort of thing, you know, have a good weekend. And then on the Monday morning, so I worked on the weekend, he comes back on Monday morning. I've done my night shift on Saturday night and Sunday night, finished 7 a.m. on Monday morning. So they're coming into work. I'm going home for the week. So that was my Friday, effectively. So there are two amenity blocks. So there's the one that the production engineers use and a few other operators, and then there's this main one, which I was in. And I don't know what was going on. I think the bathroom was full or something like that. And I thought, I'll go over and have a leak over where the production engineers' toilets are. And Jim was in there. He was standing at the locker with no shirt on, with his pants, long pants on. And I said, oh, hey, Jim. And he didn't say anything. And he sort of moved in a way so that I couldn't see in his locker. Not that I was trying to, but he was sort of on my right walking in, and the lockers were at a right angle to me, so I still wouldn't have seen in the locker anyway. And I went to the urinal, which was in a slightly different room, and then when I washed my hands and come back out, and Jim was still there in the same position with no shirt and just pants. And I said, well, I'll catch you later, Jim. Still no answer. And as I walked past again, he shuffles across to shield his locker, and I thought, yeah, fuck, well, I don't care, you know? It's the start of the weekend. He's probably in a downer, and that was it. For me, that was it. He'd gone. And I got a call from my superintendent, my manager that night, who asked me to come in. I heard a few rumours around town, but nothing sort of categoric, and, yeah, my big manager rang me up and told me to come in, and they'd set up a police station headquarters-type thing at the med centre. Yeah, I came in and answered a few questions, and yeah, that was the start of it all, basically.
Okay, let's take a moment here to go over some of what we've heard. Firstly, Chris, at this time, has worked with Jim for years. While they're not friends, He knows Jim on a high basis and works in the same department. He's familiar with Jim's personality and what would be considered normal, in a work setting at least. So it strikes me as significant that the Friday before Jim's disappearance, so 3 days before, Jim was acting in a manner so unusual to Chris that he actually made a mental note of it at the time. Remember, this was before Jim went missing, and this particular behaviour seems to be in stark contrast to what he would then exhibit over the coming days. Chris describes it as, "I've never seen him so upbeat." We know that over the coming Saturday and Sunday, Jim would exhibit the exact opposite behaviour, showing apparent distress and anxiety. So the question is, what caused this sudden change? Are these changes in mood being caused by internal issues within Jim, or is it the result of some unknown external pressure? Or is this nothing at all? It's certainly a hell of a coincidence in relation to the timing of his disappearance. One thing is certain, of all the people I've spoken to regarding Jim's behaviour at this time, this is the only account of Jim being in an upbeat, positive frame of mind. Now, when we look at Jim's reaction to Chris on the Monday morning, we see a completely different situation. Jim flatly ignores Chris's salutation. This, Chris explains, is being more normal Jim, and thinks not much of it. But then he describes going to the toilet and returning a few minutes later to see Jim still standing shirtless and motionless in the exact same position. On both occasions Chris passed, Jim maneuvered his body so as to block the view of his locker. So what was Jim doing? Again, only questions, no answers. Just to be clear, it was around 6 a.m. when Chris saw Jim. Every morning, Jim would come into work in his normal clothes and then change into his work clothes at his locker, so having no shirt on while getting changed is normal. But standing motionless for many minutes was odd, and it stood out to Chris. We can only speculate as to what Jim may have been trying to hide, if anything at all. About 30 minutes later, Anthony Karkow would later describe seeing Jim acting strange, and states in the police report he stopped, turned around and went back the way he came from. It was strange. He stopped and turned twice, like he couldn't make up his mind where he was going. But it seems that Jim was frozen in thought this morning. He was apparently grappling with something. We just don't know what.
So, now and again the name comes up and sort of we still don't know, you know. It's freaking unbelievable. You still often wonder because we were searching for a few weeks afterwards. I wasn't actually involved in the official search. We were down, I think there's a plant called the UAS where they cook the coils, and they actually opened that up, which was a plant and a furnace. And it's a massive, expensive process to stop it and then depower it and isolate it and then get inside it, you know what I mean? So just for them to do that was major. I wasn't actually part of that. But when I went back sort of a week later, I remember I had a new guy on the crew and he was sort of like obviously being briefed on what happened and stuff. And I was like, okay, guys, well, we actually need to go out and keep looking around the plant. And, you know, because in the rolling mills, there's just tunnels everywhere. There's cable tunnels, water tunnels that just go everywhere. It's a maze of tunnels underground and linked to other plants. And it's actually very scary. And it was a shitty old night. And this guy, I remember him sort of, he's a bit of a tough guy, but he's freaking out going like, I didn't sign up for this shit. Yeah. So we sort of laughed it off sort of thing because it's quite a hardened environment, you know. It's a lot of old school men there and it's a hard steelmaker's industrial environment. And if you come across the wrong way or whatever, you're a bit limp, you get found out pretty quick, you know. Stuff's changing now. It's kind of the way society is. But, you know, back then, it was like, it was pretty brutal.
I told you this episode was going to confuse you. The note about Jim's upbeat behaviour on the Friday afternoon only adds to this. When we view this apparent flip-flopping in behaviour during these last few days, it would seemingly point to someone going through some type of mental breakdown. And if this was the case, then it's very difficult to examine Jim's actions through any kind of rational lens. And in an episode very soon, we'll be hearing from a forensic psychiatrist who I've asked to take a fresh look at the case and will provide his professional opinion on Jim's behaviour and the possible causes. But the problem with Jim's case, as you're well aware, is that we have the unexplained discovery of the hard hat 5 days after his disappearance. And if, as we heard from Brian Meiklejohn, the helmet couldn't have been missed in the searches and it had to have been planted, then wouldn't this largely refute the mental breakdown theory, assuming Jim had already left? Unless we were to consider that somehow it was actually Jim who had placed this here himself at a later time. There are also some other conflicting issues surrounding the hard hat and whether it was even Jim's hat at all. In the photo evidence we have, it clearly shows a yellow helmet, and we know that it had Jim D written on the inside of it. However, Tracy Donnelly believes that this can't be right because Jim actually had a white helmet. If this were true, this would be significant. To try and find further clarification, I spoke to Ewan Tudoa, who worked with Jim in the same office at that time.
I did. Yeah, I did work in the same office as Jim. Yep.
How long did you guys work together for?
Maybe just on a year.
Okay.
About a year, but right up to the time that he disappeared, I was in the same office as Jim. The time that I knew him, Jim was a sort of a loner. He kept fairly much to himself, and didn't really associate much with others. But he was a sort of a standoffish, but he kept to himself most of the time. It's very hard to converse with, but had some unusual sort of traits where he'd sometimes in the office he'd be looking up at the ceiling and having a little chat and then we'd come back down to normal, but that was pretty normal for Jim. So it was just some unusual things he used to do, and one of the things he used to do. After a while, you got used to it. It was just, that was Jim. That's what he did. Mm. But the most notable thing that I do remember about Jim was, just being a loner. No friends. No, kept to himself. Didn't talk much. But as I said before, very standoffish. But that was about it. Whereas in the office environment there, most of us were sort of, you spoke to people, you had a little joke every now and then, and carried on with your work. But Jim was a wee bit different in that aspect, where he was, very quiet and sort of was gazing around and basically just keeping to himself. I do remember he used to come in to work early in the mornings and quite early, well before most people, and he would go and do his thing and his checks and what have you. That was Jim. He was by himself. But the morning that he disappeared, once again he came in early, but one of the operators saw him, and that was the last we saw of him.
At that time, did you have the same uniform that Jim would wear?
Yeah, we all had fairly much the same uniform.
And was what was that?
That was a light bluish shirt top and light blue denim, or blue trousers. And, that was our uniform for our area. So we didn't all come in sort of in mufti. We all had a uniform that was provided to us by the steel mill. It was a normal thing. It was a standard wear that we had, and for our work environment that we worked in.
And what colour was it? Was what colour helmet did you guys use?
We mainly used white helmets.
White.
There was mainly white helmets, white or yellow. But in our office, we mainly used white or yellow, either or.
It could be either or.
I'm just trying to remember now. I think Jim had a white helmet, can't recall now.
Yeah.
But he couldn't either. But I'm sure he had a white helmet.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Helmet.
White or yellow? You probably heard the surprise in my voice, followed by disappointment. As is so often the situation in cold cases going back many years, memories can be a fickle thing. But I didn't prompt Ewan as to the colour options. He responded white before he knew anything about why I was asking. It's tantalising, but yet not conclusive. It's clear that I'm going to need more witnesses, or even better, a photo, however unlikely that might be. So much is riding on the discovery of Jim's hard hat, the implications of whether it was simply sitting in that spot the whole time and missed in the searches, or it was placed at a later time, are massive. So I really need a second opinion, someone else that works at the mill currently, that could be my eyes in a location that I've been told by the mill I won't be able to see. Peter is a current NZ Steel employee and reached out to me initially because he wanted to make sure the point was made that Jim's disappearance was due to nothing more than what they consider Jim's particularly odd character, and that whatever happened to Jim was 100% Jim's own actions. However, as we spoke further and I questioned Peter about the discovery of the hard hat, this is where he found it difficult to come up with reasonable explanations. I want to be clear. I don't have any particular bias when it comes to the case and the hard hat. I simply ask the question, could the hard hat have been missed in the search? I let their answer guide the interview. Peter went away and we spoke later after he had time to physically visit the location the helmet was found. Then we spoke again. Peter didn't want his voice used in the podcast, so I'll paraphrase our questions and answers. I explained that I was looking for a second opinion, to clarify that what Brian had said regarding the searches and the discovery of the helmet was accurate, and that it couldn't have been missed. He responded, no, they were very thorough, and says, it wasn't like we were walking around doing nothing. We were genuinely worried he was dead somewhere. He's dead in a machine somewhere, and we just can't find him. And the last thing you want to do is stumble across him in a few weeks' time in some compromising position. So yeah, 1,000,000%, there's no possibility that it could have been overlooked. Not at all. I asked Peter about the area. How accessible is it? My thought being that if it's a difficult area to search, employees may have just taken a cursory look, and as such, the helmet was missed. But he assures me that it's not an inaccessible area. There are plenty of areas in the mill that people don't visit often, where it would be conceivable that the hat could be missed, but this was not one of them. I query the idea that the moment Jim was discovered to be missing, the mill was shut down. Is it possible that because the mill wasn't operating, that perhaps the searches just didn't go down this walkway, and as such, the helmet wasn't found until the mill was operating again? And his response, no. It's such an easily accessible area. The location of the helmet was found is up a simple flight of stairs right out in the open. It's not up a ladder or any hard-to-reach place. It's not difficult to get to. And it's logical that when you walk down that walkway, you just walk straight up the stairs and the helmet would be right there. In his words, there is literally 0% chance you miss that helmet. Zero. He goes on to explain that it's a very neat and tidy area, and that a helmet like that would stick out. It's the wrong color to start. If you look at the equipment all around it, he says, it's dull metal and then the helmet is bright yellow. And it's not like it's hidden under a pillar or a corner. It's right there, halfway down the walkway. I've managed to obtain a short video of this exact location, taken not too long ago, which will provide you with a high-resolution view of exactly what this location looks like and where the helmet was found. You can find this on my Instagram page, RyanWolfNZ, or our Facebook page, Brevity Studios NZ. Our conversation continues, and Peter makes the point that for someone to have snuck back and placed the helmet days after, which seems has obviously been the case, then they would have had, in his words, to have balls of steel. There's no social area nearby where a person can whip out the door and place it there. They'd have to walk all the way out in the open with the helmet in their hand, which would stand out. Unless, of course, the plant's been shut down at night time. Then no one may have been in there. Through this podcast so far, it's been made clear that NZ Steel is a 24/7 operation. And it is. But does the night operation mimic the day operation? Are there the same number of staff around? Could you move without being seen? The short answer is yes.
You could move around in there at night. You could move around and not be detected. Some instances, as of during the day, there's a lot more people, but at night, it's just a skeleton crew running and what have you, and you could move around. But that's the way it was. At night, it's mainly 50s, just the bare essential crews to run the lines. And during the day, you have to have the 50 of the essential crews, but you also have all the day staff. So there was a lot more, so you couldn't be seen. But at night or early in the morning,
pretty quiet.
It was very quiet. It was very quiet. Yeah. So if somebody saw you could. As you know, he can do anything or hide something or take something, but it wouldn't be sort of seen, you know? You could if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But during the day, it'd be a lot harder.
That was Ewan Tudoa again, describing a mill at night that would present opportunity to move without being seen. And at the very time I was writing this episode, I spoke to another NZ Steel employee that worked at the time Jim went missing and still works there today. He is used to working the night shift, so understands night operation and what would be possible. He stated that as it was back in 2004, it would have been very easy to leave the site and come back unseen at night. Remember that in 2004, as hard as it is to believe now, there were no fences preventing a person from simply walking on site from virtually any direction. And the number of staff present during the night shift is significantly lower, just enough to safely run the plants. We also know that the searches of the plant and surrounding areas did not operate 24/7, meaning if someone were to wait until these searches had concluded for the night, they could quite possibly have a clear path to enter the rolling mill and place the helmet and possibly throw Jim's other items into the acid bath and then leave, undetected. So what does this tell us? I believe that this means that whoever placed Jim's helmet next to Ringarole number 1 more than likely did this on the night of Friday, 25th of June, 2004. As a result, the hard hat was then discovered the following day. I'm confident that I can now discount any possibility that the hard hat was simply missed in the earlier searches. So the question is, why place the hard hat in this location? Well, we can speculate, and there are a couple possibilities that stand out. The first one is simply one of physics. The acid bath that was drained, in which Jim's belongings were found, had a steel lid cover that weighed approximately 500 kilos. However, there was one access point, a small round lid which could have been removed separately, like a mini manhole. It would have been through this access point that someone would have thrown the items later found. However, the hard hat would not have fit through this access hole. Is it possible that someone, in a rush to get rid of these loose items, threw the smaller pieces, like the cards and the keys, in the tank, and then realizing the helmet wouldn't fit, simply placed it in the nearest possible location so as not to be seen carrying it? I'm going to include a photo of a standard NZ Steel hard hat sitting right next to this very access point. And while it obviously won't fit, it's also not that far off. Because what would be the purpose of effectively concealing the smaller items to then simply place a much larger, obvious, bright yellow helmet with Jim's name inside right next to it? It's this question that leads to the second, much more curious option, and one that I discussed with Dave Glossop all the way back in episode 2.
If you're going to hide something, the last thing you're going to do is put a big massive signpost on the front of it saying, hey, look in here.
This second bizarre possibility is that the hard hat was placed here specifically to alert the authorities to check inside the acid vat, where they would then find the other items. But it begs the question as to why. Why direct someone to this location? Why put the items in the vat if you want them to be found? It's worth noting here that Dave Glossop mentioned that they also found a number of perfect squares of denim. Had these been thrown in at a much earlier time, or were they somehow connected? Also, a jacket label named Dean, D-E-A-N-E, was found in the vat. Is this connected to Jim's items? Or is all of this just meaningless? Is there no rational answer to be found? Could it be the result of a person who has possibly had some type of mental breakdown, acting completely erratically? Is it possible that Jim did re-enter the mill during the cover of night, which we know would have been quite possible without being seen, and placed these items for some reason known only to him? When I started this investigation, I thought this seemed fanciful. But a recent discovery has opened the door just a crack to this possibility. At 2:30 p.m. on 29 June 2004, an NZ Steel operator made a startling discovery. This was Jim's dirty pants in the laundry area of the steel plant amenity block. I believe this piece of evidence has largely been overlooked. In Dave Glossop's mind, this is likely just a laundry error, common enough among businesses with large numbers of staff like NZ Steel. To me, it felt like far too much of a coincidence. But also, I considered it quite possible that Dave was right, and it was just a red herring. But when I reached out to the employee that found these pants, he added a detail that I had never heard, and frankly, blew me away. It may seem innocuous, and in fact, it took me some time to process, but I believe it could possibly be one of the most significant pieces of evidence as to the events that took place over those first 5 days. And I've just been going through Jim's sort of whole case from start to finish and just trying to see if there's anything that's been overlooked.
Right.
And one of the things, obviously, that sort of stands out is when you found his laundry his pants in the locker. I was just wondering if you could just take me back to what you can remember of finding those and anything in particular that stuck out.
Well, nothing stuck out. Well, there's cow shit on the laundry, but he had nothing to do with our plant. I'm in the steel plant and he's way over the rolling mills, which is about half a K away.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that's the weird thing. That's what I told the cops anyway.
Yeah. So when you went in, it sounds silly, but just describe to me sort of the laundry place and how it works.
Okay. So we've got a laundry lady that every day when the laundry comes back from the dry cleaners, they put into our separate pods, our numbered pods for each individual. And then, of course, if there's any overflow or stuff that they can't work out what fits or what unnamed or whatever, it all gets chucked in another area, which is a couple of great big cubby holes. And so we were having problems with our laundry being returned on time and stuff like that. So I was short of laundry, so I was looking for some more clothes, basically. So I went over to the overflow area and pulled out a pair of trousers about almost about the right size for me, I thought. and then and saw cow shit on them. So, well, they shouldn't be here in the first place. And then I saw the name. Yeah, because it was actually labelled, you know, Jim Donnelly. So I thought, fucking hell.
Yeah.
So I left it there. Left it there where I found it and went around the corner to the telephone and rang my supervisor. Did you better come have a look at this?
Yeah.
That's all I told the cops, I'm afraid.
And did they never said anything more to you?
No. They came around and I had an interview with an officer at my home and that was it. Yeah, basically I've just told them pretty much what I told you. Yeah. That's all I can tell you.
So you said it had cow shit on it?
Yes.
Huh. You specifically remember definitely like cow shit or something like that?
Yeah. It was cow shit. Yeah, it was wet cow shit as well, as in like when it's a dry cow patty, it's just, you know, dry grass, but this has been wet stuff that it was on there.
What did you make?
It's already wet. I made nothing of it. That's what I reported it, and that's what I said to the cops as well. It was up to them to sort that out.
Yeah, but I mean, just as a, I'm just trying to think of it, you know, like as a person, sort of, what are you, I mean, does it look like someone that's been walking through a paddock or something like that, or?
Oh, it was weird. No, it was like it had been splattered onto them, but it was in our clean laundry area. That's what the wet thing was. Yeah, they were in the cubby holes where just the overflow and unclaimed stuff, basically.
Yeah. Okay, but it's all the sort of...
Well, see, the cows would be... cow shit would be from our plants, would be, I don't know, 2K away.
Yeah, that's odd, isn't it?
I suppose. Yeah. There are paddocks as we drive in towards Stanmore.
Yeah.
But that's nowhere near where I was.
Yeah, because I've been out there and, you know, when you go in and then obviously on the left there's paddocks...
Yes.
Around there. I mean, I'm sure there'd be cows around the place, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's weird. So that overflow, is that sort of sometimes like they do the laundry and then some clean stuff, it all just gets thrown in that spot.
Yeah, and it's still the same. It's still the same setup after, was it 25 years or 20 years when that happened?
But
ever since I've been there. Yep.
But all that stuff that's in there is always clean.
Well, yeah. Well, that's because it's when it's come back, it's been washed, and then it's when the laundry lady can't work out where it's supposed to be, or if there's, you know, if it's unlabeled.
Yeah.
And so they can't put in their lockers. Because there would be 250 guys there, you know, labeled lockers and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's a fair bit of work for the lady to do.
Yeah. I mean, so she would never throw that dirty laundry in that spot. It would have to be someone else.
I can't talk to you about that. Sorry.
Yeah, we'd assume so. If she was doing what she would normally do.
Yeah. Yeah.
How often would people out there, you know, you might wear someone else's clothes, you know, like just, you know, how you were saying you might just grab something else. Is that pretty common?
About a month and a half ago, a lot of it was going on because we couldn't get our laundry back. When there's like the COVID thing and all the rest of it, it gets sent away. We're using a set each day, and we normally got about four or five sets on the go, and because we work four on, four off. If you do overtime, you're getting short, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. As easy as that.
Yeah. So when you said, just to clarify, when you said wet cow shit, you mean it was dry at the time you saw it, but it would have been wet kind of when it went on, or do you mean it was kind
of... Yes. Yeah, that's it. That's what I mean, yeah. Sorry, I should have clarified that. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Oh, that's... And you didn't know Jim, eh? You just seen photos of him or something?
I've only seen photos. I've never met the guy. I do remember the day we shut down, though, to look for him. Back in 2004,
yeah,
we the whole Stanmore shut down for 4 hours, and we all went. We had to cover every crane rail, every ladder, you name it, down in the holes in the dungeons, you name it. We had to do the lot, cover every square inch of our plant.
There's a lot. Yeah. There could be an explanation that someone else has just happened to have worn his pants and thrown them there, but it's still a hell of a coincidence.
Yeah, especially labelled with his name as well. Yeah.
So each area, like, they have their own laundry service?
Well, the same laundry service, but we've all got identifying plant numbers, and that's why the laundry goes from our plant and comes back to our plant.
Yeah. Sorry, that's what I mean. You've got your own sort of laundry room you pick it up from kind of thing. Okay.
Yeah. When it's delivered,
Just, that's certainly very interesting.
I thought so too when I saw the trousers there, but there. Like I say, I just told the relevant people and let it be.
What colour do you remember? Did everyone wear the same colour pants? It, like, you know, is it all?
Well, the pants I pulled out were actually the light blue cotton, which was what he was, because Jim was a technician.
Yeah.
And so that's what they would have been wearing. Whereas for me personally, I was looking for them because I was in the control room, which is our controllers wear those because we don't go anywhere near the hot stuff.
Yeah.
While we're doing that job, but most of the time I'm predominantly wearing orange wool trousers and jacket because I'm with Molten Steel, you see.
Yeah. Oh, so these are just sort of a light cotton kind of trouser.
Yep.
Not like a heavy duty sort of thing.
No, they're designed to be in the control room, so it's nice and comfortable to wear. Nice cotton instead of wearing wool.
That makes it even weirder that they've got wet cow shit on them. So you do mean like sort of up the leg, as if a cow's like been standing by you and shat on your leg, kind of thing.
Yeah, it was hard. I didn't actually take much notice and didn't take a photo. It was too long ago. But I seem to remember it was it wasn't down on the bottom of the cuff where if you're walking through a paddock and you're, you know, like scuffing up the inside of your legs, if you'd stepped in some cow shit, it was like more like a splatter by memory, up around sort of around your knee, your thigh area by memory.
Did you catch it? The piece that could hold the key? You probably know what I'm talking about, but what makes cow shit splattered up the legs of trousers so important? Let's break this down. Firstly, we'll recap what we just heard. The employee enters the steel plant amenity block, which is situated some 500 meters north of the rolling mills plant where Jim works. He's looking for a different pair of pants, as his haven't come back from the laundry. In each laundry room, there's effectively a lost property cubbyhole, where clean items that the laundry attendant can't find a home for are placed. This pile of clean laundry is a permanent fixture, and it's common for employees to use items from this pile when their own haven't returned. He grabs a pair of blue cotton pants out of this pile, but realizes that they're covered in cow shit, splattered up to the knees. This is a pair of dirty trousers and a clean pile of laundry. Thinking this is odd, he checks the tag and is shocked to see the name Jim Donnelly inside and alerts the authorities. Before we move any further, I want to reiterate to you how employees at NZ Steel handle their work uniforms. Every day, they arrive at work in their casual clothes. They then change into their work uniform at their locker. At the end of the day, they remove their work clothes and place them in the laundry before changing back into their casual clothes and heading home. The key thing to note here is that their work uniforms don't leave NZ Steel property. Jim largely worked in an office setting. As a result, his uniform differed from, say, someone who works with Molten Steel. On a day-to-day basis, Jim would wear a light blue cotton trouser. This is because, for the most part, technicians don't generally get as dirty. So how can we explain the splattered cow shit up the legs of Jim's blue trousers, found 8 days after Jim's disappearance? And let's think about how the cow shit was described, because I believe this could be critically important. It was described as splatter, specifically not the type you would get from walking. And I would say that it sounds like the type of splatter you would get from running. As the front leg lands in a wet cow shit, it splatters onto the back leg, and so forth. So how could this possibly be? Let's run through a fictitious scenario. I'm not necessarily saying that this happened, but let's let the evidence speak for itself. On the morning of June 21st, 2004, for a reason we don't know, Jim leaves NZ Steel sometime after he was seen at 8:30 a.m. by Dean Forsman. He's reported as wearing an orange jacket.
And we did have those orange jackets also, because I always remember him wearing those.
This type of orange jacket is ubiquitous on site, and is worn by all lower level general staff. In the words of a current employee, a person wearing one of these jackets anywhere in the mill would be able to move freely without drawing any attention, as opposed to a technician who would stand out. If you're wearing an orange jacket throughout the mill, no one would blink an eye. We don't know, but in this scenario, We're going to say he left on foot, likely heading to the north. Jim proceeds to conceal himself in farmland, a distance away from the mill, far enough away that the subsequent searches in the close surrounding area of the mill don't reveal his location, perhaps up to 2 kilometres. The searches proceed for the entire week, concluding around dark each night. The wider search draws to a close around Friday the 25th. At this point, Jim, again for reasons unknown, decides to make his way back to the mill to plant the hard hat next to the acid vat at ringer roll number 1. Coming from the north, Jim runs through paddocks in the dark, splattering cow shit up the legs. On entering the mill, he passes directly past the steel plant, which is approximately 500 metres to the north of the rolling mills plant. Considering he's been out in the elements and is now covered in cow shit, he enters the laundry, knowing here he can find fresh clothes that won't arouse any suspicion from the unclaimed laundry pile. I've checked, and yes, the laundry is open 24 hours a day, and it would be no problem to move here, in the night, unseen. This laundry pile is large, and I've been told that it's not unusual for clothes to sit here, unclaimed, for years. Jim locates a fresh pair of trousers, removes his own, and throws them in there with the other unclaimed clothes. He then proceeds to make his way to the rolling mill plant, where he places his hard hat, before again leaving the mill to places unknown. I know this theory contains so many whys, some of which can be easily explained, and others, not so much. If Jim left the mill without being seen, then why wait for 5 days before returning to place the hard hat, risking being found? And if this is the case, for what purpose? Was Jim running from someone? What was Jim hiding from Chris at the locker the morning he went missing? Clearly, there was something he didn't want Chris to see. And if Jim was last seen wearing an orange jacket, as Dean Forsman claims, was this change in clothes a purposeful act by Jim to help him blend into the crowd? Or did he just want some warm clothes? And how does all of this tie in with Jim's odd and erratic behaviour in the days leading up to his disappearance? There are still so many questions here. But there's one thing that no matter which way you look at it, just can't be explained away as mere coincidence. How did those blue trousers, with the name tag Donnelly, show up in a completely separate plant 8 days after Jim's disappearance, covered in cow shit? There is quite literally no situation in which any other employee who may have happened to be wearing Jim's pants could have splattered cow shit up the legs. I may not yet have all the answers. Far from it. But in my mind, there's one thing I've become sure of. And that's that someone was running through those fields around the mill in the dark, in those pants, during that time. And I believe that person was Jim. Guilt is written, produced, and edited by me, Ryan Wolfe. The title track is Nuclear Conception by Alison Winter. Voice acting in this episode, Mike Williams. For further photos and video related to this episode, you can check my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ, or our Facebook page, Brevity Studios NZ. For ad-free listening and bonus content, you can subscribe for the price of a coffee on Apple Plus. You can also find further information on our website, www.theguiltpodcast.com. If you have any information related to the disappearance of Jim Donnelly or the subsequent search at the mill, you can contact us anonymously at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.